Hello and welcome to the Leap of Faith. Well, there's a city feel to tonight's programme, from the turmoil of modern-day Jerusalem, and we'll be going there shortly, to that same holy site when it was once known as Royal David's City, the inspiration for one of our most well-loved carols, the words of which were written by a remarkable woman from Dublin. But first, he's got more followers on Twitter than some well-known politicians, countless celebrities, and even myself. Midlands priest Father Paddy Byrne is a prodigious tweeter, blogger and social justice campaigner, and he's here with me in the studio this evening. Father Paddy, you were for a time one of the youngest priests in Ireland. Was that a lonely place for a young man to be?
To speak about loneliness in terms of priesthood, it's often perceived that we aren't happy out there. So I'm amazed often that say, oh Godfather, the last thing I would want my son to be as a priest, because it's such a lonely life. And I often wonder what in our body language, in our demeanour as priests, what are we communicating to people?
Well, historically you were held very highly in the community. You know, people lifted their hat, maybe genuflected, and held the priests in the parish as in a very powerful position. That trust was broken, and now you have a situation where people are not quite sure how there are still good men putting themselves into this situation where they're going to be in a tough spot.
Yeah, and I have always, during the whole crisis, I have in my priesthood known nothing but a church in crisis, a church that put itself, its institution, before people, a church that covered up all that element that became, to me, the norm, while dysfunctional as it was. That was the church that I ministered in. And I have to say, I always saw two churches in Ireland. There was the local church, and then there was the other church. Mm. And like, particularly in Portlaoise, I can say, and there's a whole generation as well now. Like, I'm coming from a situation today where over 250 young men engaged in a very spiritual way in conversation with the priests of the parish. But that there's a whole sense I see now of, without trying to put this conversation under the carpet, but people have moved on. Now, some have moved on by saying, I want nothing to do with this church. But there's a whole generation of young people who have no memory of the previous church. Like, I'm speaking personally now as a priest, that I was never really put up there as any big hero or somebody to be reverential towards. I think actions speak louder than words.
Now, you make reference in your book, which is All Will Be Well, about how people perceive their relationship with the church. And there's a slightly light touch for some Catholics as to how they relate to the church, using it for the hatch, match and dispatch, the baptism, the wedding and the funeral.
Yeah, and I think, you know, by and large, I was greatly enthused by the census of 2016, where still, after all that the Catholic Church has gone through, in the privacy of their own homes, 78% of citizens on this republic ticked the box in the privacy of their own home that they identified themselves as part of the Catholic tradition. I think the day of measuring our numbers in terms of who's with us or who's not with us, I think that day has to end. I'm big into the conversation of welcome, of people connect with us at key moments of the year. We're coming up to Christmas. In Portlaoise, for instance, you know, a parish 24,000, we will get perhaps out of that 24,000, 17,000 or 18,000 will actually visit the church over Christmas Eve and Christmas Day. They may not come to us for the rest of the year, but what they're doing is honouring perhaps an inner moment of reflection. They're saying, we recognise that Jesus is part of our personal faith story. And to be blunt about it, in the hospital, you know, I'm not going around the hospital beds in Portlaoise saying, were you at Mass on Sunday? But what I am calling to do is to be present to vulnerable people. And that it's rare they say, Father, go away, will you? That they actually, men, women, young, not so young, often turn to the God question when they're vulnerable.
And people often will also judge the man that they see in front of them as against the collar or what he's wearing. I'm thinking, though, about that idea that if you were to take a lot of those people that will present themselves and go to Mass, but their theology may not be as pure as a conservative Catholic would want it to be.
Again, you know, people figure out, as a Catholic, there are the the fundamentals of our Christian faith, but I think there's room for everybody in this church. And I think it's a call, as Pope Francis tells us repeatedly, as particularly as priests, to witness hope in a time of despair. And particularly these weeks of Advent coming close to Christmas, it is a challenging time, but the birth that happened over 2,000 years ago isn't just a historical one. For those who are listening to this conversation, it's also a personal one. That to have, as Patrick Kavanagh tells us in that very beautiful poem, Advent, to retrieve a sense of wonder. And, you know, we live in an instant world. We have it on Snapchat. We want to get that good, so we go online and it comes to us very quickly. Do we do wonder and awe in this world? And I see a huge amount of people engaging in things like, it's cool in a secular world to say mindfulness or yoga or seeking that place that brings peace. And as a member of the Catholic tradition, where else but for me as a priest ministering, the sacraments engage us, not just in faith, but also through our senses. And I see so many, many people hungry for the spiritual and that spirituality to grow within themselves.
I'm chatting this evening with Father Paddy Byrne. Paddy, who cares for you?
I'm blessed to be a twin. And that's my fundamental gift in my life. I'm a twin. And my twin brother is a very, very strong soulmate. He's not married, Noel. He lives in Carlow. And I think we have a loving relationship as a twin. Those who are listening, you know, every morning, invariably, I have moments where I'm texting him and his text arrives. So say like for Christmas, he will come to me and I have a hectic time because Christmas Eve this year is on a Sunday and we're straight in then to celebrating Christmas Day. So he will come and we will chill out together for Christmas. And it's lovely to have that intimate friendship and connection with
somebody. But if you didn't have him, where would you be?
Well, I think, you know, God is very, when we trust in God, he provides good people. And like, just because you're a priest doesn't mean that you're exempt from having human relationships with people. I'm very fortunate perhaps to have people, particularly family, who love me and care for me. And certainly my twin when I was growing up, for instance, was a much bigger guy than I was. We were born premature. He was 3 pound, I was 2 pound, but he got bigger than I did. And if anybody was bullying me or saying anything he didn't like, I'd have somebody to be able to defend me at all times.
Do you think if vocations were to return to even an acceptable level where there was at least a replacement of the people who are leaving or who are coming to the end of their life, would the ability to have a life partner to marry be contingent on changing that?
I think it's certainly an option that has to be addressed by the church and those who are in authority within it. I don't think, and I'm speaking personally here, that marriage should be an impediment to ordination. I feel it perhaps would be a more fulfilling experience of humanity for some people as well, if they had, as you name, a life partner or a wife or a family to share the reality of life with.
And I'm going to guess that your parish wouldn't function without women.
Those of you who are part of faith communities know exactly that women are the lifeblood of the church. In our parish, women lead our parish, particularly in their gifts of administration, of facilitating so many important things that happen. One thing, this again is me personally speaking, I was disappointed, for instance, that while the ministry of permanent diaconate has become normal in many dioceses in this country, that women weren't promoted to that role, at least in terms of acknowledging their fundamental gifts and talents. And I think it's a big loss to the permanent diaconate, particularly. The question of ordination to priesthood, I think it's a more theological one. And, you know, I just to be blunt about it, I can't see that theologically happening down the road, but I do see in terms of acknowledging the role of women that women must be given a place around the table.
Finally, the idea that you have taken to the Twitter sphere at Father Paddy Byrne, being the handle, and what, over nearly 14,000 followers, what do you say to them and what do they say to you?
Okay, well, firstly, it sounds shockingly egotistical to say that Jesus had 12 followers, Father Paddy has 14,000 followers.
Very egotistical. You're in trouble for that one, all right.
But no, I think I began, like, you know, there's a whole age out there that's about communication. And at the heart of the gospel, and particularly as a priest, we're told to get out there and to get into the conversation of life and to spread the good news. So I just began being a voice on Twitter a few years ago, but I did see it as an opportunity to put out positive inspirational thoughts, to make comment, because if the church can't make comment about life, about healthcare.
Do you get in trouble for those comments?
Yes, in terms of officialdom, never. But in terms of not everybody shares my opinion, and through those of us, and the vast majority of us engage in social media, we know that there will often be other voices.
You're going to get singed every
Absolutely.
Now and then.
Absolutely. Yeah. But I think that my Twitter account obviously has proven to be attractive to people, and I do genuinely try to offer hope in the tweets that I send out.
So let me go back to the title that you put on the book, All Will Be Well. Is this a hope or a belief that you have?
I think it's a sense, and I think it's also it's grounded in my faith in Jesus Christ, that those of you who are listening this evening may have gone through that grey day, may have gone through that horrible moment of bereavement or separation or struggle in life. Who among us in our humanity doesn't go through those grey days? But there's a gentle voice, a voice that whispers, all will be well. A voice that tells us it's okay at times not to be okay, but also that life is bigger than the now moment. I'm very conscious that so many people listening are dreading Christmas, that so many people are aware that Christmas brings vulnerability, particularly where family life, where we're gathering around that table for the meal, and that the meal will also be a challenge for people, and particularly for those who have no meal and those who aren't able to gather around the table. So it's a prayer I make, and I make it many times a day for me personally, but for those who I minister with, all will be well.
And All Will Be Well is the title of Father Paddy Byrne's new book. And for all details, just go to our website, rte.ie/The Leap of Faith. Well, next this evening, President Donald Trump's announcement that the United States will recognise Jerusalem as the capital of Israel has drawn a polarised reaction around the world. Trump's declaration will trigger a process of relocating the US embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. Both Palestine and Israel have a territorial claim to the contested capital, and there's been an international understanding that two separate states for the groups could be created. Well, joining us on the line from Jerusalem, in fact from outside the Holy Sepulchre Church, is Professor Helen Bond, Professor of Christian Origins in New College, University of Edinburgh. Helen, thank you for joining us on The Leap of Faith. You're on the ground there. What has been the reaction since Wednesday and the declaration?
Oh, great shock, I think, and huge disappointment. I know this wasn't entirely unexpected, but still, you know, once the announcement came out, people are just waiting for what's going to happen, especially today after the Friday prayers. Normally on a Friday, there's religious processions. People walk along the Via Dolorosa and they're joined by tourists. They're holding crosses, you know, thinking about the Good Friday story. But all of that was cancelled this morning.
People mightn't be aware of the extent to which in Jerusalem there are very much three faiths present, and a lot of the Muslim part of Jerusalem, the Christian part, are under the custodian of Jordan. Will that remain, do you think?
Oh, well, yes. I mean, all of that's going to remain at the moment. I mean, all Trump has done is to move his, or talk about moving his embassy. So that doesn't actually affect anything politically, and nor should it, I think. I mean, it's up to the people here to work out the solution that works best for them. But yeah, I mean, you're right. I mean, it's because there's so much faith investment here. You know, Jerusalem isn't just any old city. It's the absolute heart of the faith for three groups. I mean, Christians and particularly Muslims. I mean, I think it's those Palestinians who are absolutely shocked at this cavalier announcement on the part of President Trump that he is going to recognize Jerusalem as the capital of Israel, because I mean for Palestinians this is one of their most holy places. This is somewhere they absolutely have to have access to on their own terms. There's no other way of looking at it.
Have you been able to observe any reaction from people in Israel to the world condemnation? Is probably a strong word, but that's been the reaction from a lot of world leaders to this declaration.
Yeah, I think people people are aware of that. I mean, obviously, from the Israeli point of view, or at least some Israelis, this is a good thing. It's what they wanted, what they hoped for, and it's what they're moving towards. But it's, you know, on the part of the Palestinians, this is absolutely dreadful. It's a cavalier, high-handed attitude from somebody who's really completely outside this whole region and clearly doesn't really understand that. So, I mean, I think it's good that, you know, papers here and the news, the television news is sort of reporting that condemnation, and people have been quick to do that. But it's still just very worrying.
Professor Helen Bond, thank you for joining us from Jerusalem, indeed from outside the Holy Sepulchre Church on the Leap of Faith.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
The wonderful sound of Once in Royal David's City, the music of which we'll talk about in a moment, and the words of which have an even more interesting story. Well, this evening we've come to the home of the Reverend Dean William Morton at St. Patrick's Cathedral in Dublin. And it's the Dean who's actually playing the organ for us in his living room in the deanery. Dean Morton, thank you for inviting us in. So tell us, why are we listening to Once in Royal David City this evening?
Well, we find ourselves just a few weeks off the great festival of Christmas, and there will be scores of Christmas services, carol services being held, hardly one of which will happen without those words being sung. The story of Once in Royal David City goes back to 1818. To 25 Eccles Street in Dublin, which is where Cecil Frances Humphreys, who was later to become Cecil Frances Alexander in her marriage, was born. The writer of, we reckon, about 150 hymns, three of the most famous of which are Once in Royal David City, All Things Bright and Beautiful, and There is a Green Hill Far Away. And as a young girl at school, at primary school, Cecil Frances seemed to have an absolute flair for composing rhyming lines. And this continued, actually, when she moved with her family to County Wicklow. And the beautiful scenery of Wicklow, recognised as the Garden of Ireland, may well have influenced her in some of her writings. They were on the move again, actually, the Humphreys family, when she was aged about 15 and travelled north to Strabane, where her father became land steward to the Marquess of Abercorn. And so time went on, and she built up her collection of writing, and these were brought together and published in 1847 under the title Hymns for Little Children.
Well, Dean, you mentioned A Green Hill Far Away. Let's hear a few notes from that particular composition. That you actually get to play it for us here on the programme as well. Now, the hills around Derry in 1847 might have been the inspiration for that piece.
A lot of people in Derry believe that she got the inspiration for A Green Hill Far Away when, as the bishop's wife, she sat in the palace in Bishop Street, just across from the deanery, and looked out towards the city cemetery and saw the green hill of the Craigan, you know, and had this idea of, as Derry's a walled city, the walls of the city of Jerusalem, outside of which Jesus was crucified, and she got this idea. Now, I don't want to burst anybody's bubble, but the hymn was actually published in 1847, long before she found herself sitting in the palace in Bishop Street. But that is not to say that maybe as a young girl She was with her parents visiting the bishop of the day in the palace and may well have had that inspiration from the view which she saw from there, and the dew and the mist and the fog and all of this here. So it's a stunning sort of an image, and it may have appealed to her.
Dean, you talk about her as if you know her very well. How did you develop an interest in Cecil Frances Alexander?
I think a lot of people, probably from a very early age, who have been brought up in a mainstream denomination will probably have a knowledge of her almost without actually realizing it. In that, in Sunday school, for example, 5 or 6 years of age, I would have been learning Once in Royal David City. And these are hymns that many would have learnt, you know, as children. And it's interesting, they were actually written for children, and they were written to express a Christian truth through rhyming couplets. They were written to answer fundamental questions about the Christian faith that her godsons had been asking, like, for example, who made the world? And what characterizes them is the tremendous simple words that she uses that even a child can understand, but yet at the same time there is an amazing profundity in the theological thinking that she's expressing.
Now, she's a woman of her time, and when we look at All Things Bright and Beautiful, which is a hymn that has been sung in many an assembly, there was one particular verse in there about the king in his castle and the poor person at the gate. Since been dropped, is that because of the woman's theology or that she was of her time?
I think sometimes that somewhat of an injustice has been done to Cecil Frances in that regard. Some people seem to think that she was saying there is always going to be class distinction. And if you find yourself, you know, impoverished, there is nothing that you can do in life to improve your lot and to move out of that. I don't think she was saying that at all. Quite the reverse, actually. She was saying that whether you happen to be living in a large house, in a castle, or whether you're living in a cottage, you have been made in the image of God. You are God's creation, and God loves you. And I think that is the message that she was trying to get across, but she sometimes slightly misinterpreted about what she wrote.
And yet, you might suggest that she's a formidable woman.
I always thought she was a formidable woman. There was a large portrait of both herself and her husband hanging in the deanery in Bishop Street in Derry. And I've come down the stairs over the 19 years that I was there as dean, and I always felt that she was looking upon me very seriously every morning and coming down the stairs. But she was a lady of immense kindness and sincerity, and the stories are legion of she and her husband walking over gorse land when her husband William, who was to become the Bishop of Derry and Raphoe actually in 1867, but when he was in his first parish, Killeter, in the heart of County Tyrone, stories are of them walking over miles and miles of gorse land and bog land to visit people who were ill, maybe elderly people on their own, and to bring them pots of jam or cakes of homemade bread, to bring them maybe clothes if they were very poor. Her good gestures were amazing and are recorded in history.
There's no doubt people hearing that will be reminded of either school assemblies or Sunday school indeed. She didn't write the music, she did write the words.
She wrote the words. But what is amazing is that there is a perfect marriage of words and music in many of her hymns. And I think that is actually one of the finest examples there, only matched, I think, by There Is a Green Hill Far Away, which was actually described by the French composer Gounod as the most perfect Christian hymn.
You spent a great deal of time studying her work, but if you were able to use a little bit of magic and meet her face to face, what would you love to have asked her directly?
I would love to ask her how she assesses her life now, having been born in what was then really a location about a mile from the centre of Dublin City, in Eccles Street, to having her portrait on the wall of the deanery in Bishop Street in Derry, and ending up with having one of her hymns sung from King's College, Cambridge, and transmitted on television on Christmas Eve. And I will never forget the experience of listening to that and watching that on television and wandering out into the hall and looking at her portrait and thinking to myself, I wonder, do you realise that the words you wrote as poetry are now being sung worldwide? It's an amazing thought.
And that's The Leap of Faith for this Friday. We'll be back at the same time next week from all of us on the programme here tonight. Good night.